Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, it's Hamish from the Young Investors Podcast. Myself and Brandon are excited to bring you your weekly rundown of the latest business and investing news from around the world. A quick reminder before we get started, any advice provided by Brandon is general and does not consider your financial situation, needs, or objectives, so consider whether it's appropriate for you. Brandon van der Kolk is authorized to provide general financial product advice in Australia and is authorized representative number 1305795 of Guideway Financial Services Proprietary Limited, AFSL number 420367. Please see the description box for Brandon's financial services guide. Past performance is not a reliable indication of future investment returns. But with that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast.
All right, everyone, welcome back to yet another episode. Hello, Hamish.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing well. It's a bit of a sad week in the investing finance
right?
business world. Yeah, Mr. I'm sure most people have probably seen Mr. Charlie Munger, vice chairman of Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's right-hand man, unfortunately passed away this week at the age of 99.
The saddest thing is that he only had 2 months and he was going to be 100.
I know. Yeah, it's crazy, right? Because I think CNBC did an interview with him recently that was supposed to be released for his 100th birthday, and now we're starting to kind of get clips of that come out, and I guess they'll kind of move that interview more into a kind of a memorial for him and his life, rather than for his 100th birthday, of course. It's a shock for the timing of it, but it's also, you know, he's lived obviously a fantastic long life.
It was very sad. I woke up and Tash broke the news to me. I was quite sad.
Yeah,
It's surprising how an event so anticipated still caught me so much by surprise. I think is because he was 99. Humans don't live, you know, very few of us live to 99. So it's a very anticipated event. They've been speaking about it at Berkshire for years, this succession plan and all that. But I still found it so, I was very shocked still when it happened. And I think it was even more, I was caught more by surprise when it happened, because he's all the way up until his death, he was sharp. He was with it. Mentally, he was there. His body was frail, but he was 99, but he didn't seem like a man that was dying. He was still, very mentally with it. I listened to the Acquired podcast featuring Charlie Munger, which was not that long ago. And he sounded good. So yeah, I think it's just a bit of a shock, but I guess it's a positive. I guess we should take that as a positive. The good thing is that of all the things, he had a great mind right up until the end. And it was ultimately his body that failed him, not his mind. So
yeah. And,
I think that's one positive.
Yeah. And I think it was, you know, it's fortunate that we were able to go. We've been to, Omaha to two Berkshire meetings the last 2 years. And we got to see him sit alongside Warren Buffett and answer questions. And it's not going to be the same again next year. It'll certainly be different. He's certainly probably a top two, maybe even top one person who's influenced my personal investing journey over my life the most. It is very sad.
It's an interesting thing because we say that, we subscribe more to the Warren Buffett style of investing. But at the end of the day, as value investors, we have to remember that Warren Buffett's style of value investing was buying cigar butts that he learned from Benjamin Graham. What we actually subscribe to now, which is buying high quality businesses at fair prices, that's Charlie Munger's approach. That was Charlie Munger teaching Warren Buffett his ways of investing. And then Warren Buffett coming around to that idea. So, yeah, definitely. If you're a Buffett style investor, you can't you can't deny that Charlie Munger has actually had a massive impact on your own investing as well. So it is very, very sad. You're right. The Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meeting will be very different without him. I'm glad that they've started to bring up Ajit and Greg in the last couple of years so that it won't feel too like replacement-ish when we go next year. But it won't be the same. Of course it won't be the same. He was a pivotal part of the Berkshire Hathaway, of Berkshire Hathaway full stop, but particularly of the Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meetings. And yeah, I guess both of us were just very, very lucky. We're very privileged to have been able to go and see them live for 2 years. We actually got to do it, Hamish. How cool is that? We actually got to see them both doing their thing.
Yeah, it's crazy because, you know, we'd kind of spoken about it or even thought and like kind of dreamed about going to Omaha probably, you know, for quite a few years before we eventually did. So yeah, it's been a crazy journey. It's always amazing to go just meet everybody, sit at the meeting, and yeah, I do feel very blessed that we were able to at least see, you know, Charlie Munger at least a couple of times in person.
Rest in peace, Charlie. We're going to miss you, mate.
Rest in peace.
But with that said, Hamish, let's move on. What are we going to talk about today? It's a bit of a lighter news week, but there's still a couple of bits and pieces floating around. So what are you going to be talking about today?
Yeah, we've got a few pieces of kind of economic news from Australia and also the Eurozone that I'll kind of go through, you know, inflation updates around those regions. I found a pretty funny... a case of, I've called it maybe a contender for the dumbest case of securities fraud ever. So, I always get excited finding like, really obscure, interesting, stories of fraud. And this isn't a big fraud case. This is no, you know, FTX, but it's kind of ridiculous. So
Hamish's fraud case of the week.
Yeah, we were actually talking about that. Like, we should try and I should like make a conscious effort to try and find a lot of these things because there's so many little fraud cases that are just funny. Like, because they're just silly.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of insane how these people thought they'd get away with what they're doing. So I should try and make it like a regular part of the podcast.
There's always one out there that we can have a laugh about. There's always somebody doing something absolutely ridiculous. We actually could make that a weekly segment. Yeah, I think we'd have quite a bit of fun doing it. But then what am I talking about? We should talk about the Shein IPO. I believe that's how you pronounce it. Shein, yep. Shein IPO. Yep. Shein. That's coming up. And Black Friday, of course, Black Friday has just been. So we got some data around the Black Friday spend this year. And geez, Elon Musk. Oh, man, the guy is absolutely off the rails now. He sat down with with CNBC, Andrew Ross Sorkin. I don't know if you know him. He's one of the CNBC anchors.
Yeah.
And he lost his cool. So we are going to talk about what he said a little bit later on in the podcast. But with that said, I should say as well, just quickly before we launch into it, just want to say thank you guys for your support over the past week of New Money Education as well. The launch went really, really well, so we're super happy with it. Really appreciate it if you guys did decide to pick up a course. Hopefully you're enjoying them. We definitely want to hear feedback. So far, the earlier reviews have been extremely positive. I haven't had any negative reviews yet, which is good, keep it that way. But I don't know. We kind of expected good reviews because we've been working for 9 months on it. It's like 10 hours of content it took us 9 months to make. So we were pretty confident going in. But nonetheless, it's still great to see. Thank you guys for the support. I won't ramble on. With that said, Hamish.
Yes.
Let's get into it.
So with that said, today's episode is brought to you by Seeking Alpha, your one-stop shop for stock analysis, market data, and news. Access expert analysis and news for thousands of stocks. If you buy, hold, and sell ratings from members, Wall Street analysts, and Seeking Alpha's own algorithm. Screen for stocks using a variety of fundamental and technical analysis metrics. Access 10 years of financial data and company filings. And manage your portfolio by tracking your investments with price alerts so you never miss a buying opportunity again. Click the link in the episode description or head directly to seekingalpha.me/younginvestors to try Seeking Alpha free for 7 days. And at the time of this going out, if you're listening to this on the first couple of days when this releases, their Black Friday deal is still going until the 5th of December. You can just use our link and access their Black Friday deal, which is a 7-day free trial and then $167 per year for their premium subscription. So if you're interested, it's a fantastic deal. Again, only available until the 5th of December. So go check that out if you're interested.
I was using Seeking Alpha the other day. I cannot remember what I was looking up though. Anyway, that's the biggest non-story of the week.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah.
Cool story, Brandon. Cool story.
Hey,
all right.
Take us.
Where should we start? I want to talk about Black Friday. Can we start there?
Yeah. Let's go.
Yeah. Let's talk about Black Friday because it's just gone. So, people spent a lot of money, Hamish.
Surprise. Shocker. I think that's the first time that's ever happened.
It is. It's crazy how, I mean, it's a marketer's dream, isn't it? To have everybody around the world just warm, just to have them all warm and ready to spend. They've already got their wallets out.
Yep.
And it doesn't matter what, they just know that they're ready to spend. It's crazy the psychology of it. It is an advertiser's dream.
Yep.
And it's also a reason that advertising is quite expensive on Black Friday because it's very lucrative. But anyway. Yep. Black Friday e-commerce spending, Hamish, popped 7.5% from a year earlier, reaching a record $9.8 billion in the US, according to an Adobe Analytics report. Further indication that price-conscious consumers want to spend on the best deals and are hunting for these deals online. Quote, "We've seen a very strategic consumer emerge over the last year, and we're really trying to take advantage of these marquee days so that they can maximize on discounts," said Vivek Pandya, a lead analyst at Adobe Digital Insights. Black Friday's spending spike reflects a customer who is more willing to spend than in 2022, when gas and food prices were painfully high. Pandya noted that impulse purchases may have played a role in the Black Friday growth since 5.3 billion of the online sales came from mobile shopping.
Wow.
He noted that influencers and social media advertising have made it easier for consumers to get comfortable spending on their mobile devices. So there you go. 7.5% increase year over year. I don't know. I feel like that's a big rise. I feel like that's quite a chunk.
Yeah, it's a big rise, especially considering the massive... I mean, they mentioned that food and gas have kind of moderated, but every other expense has been going up at a high rate. It's like, it's not like we're in deflation this year. I mean, inflation is...
And savings are as low as ever.
Yeah, I mean, so what's inflation this year? Still 4, 5, 6%, depending on where you are. So that's, 4, 5, 6%. Prices are 4, 5, 6% higher than last year, even excluding kind of all the inflation that came before that. So... Yeah, it is crazy to see. It's insane to see that people are still still have money that they want to spend on things. And there could be an effect that people kind of saving more up for these Black Friday deals because of the cost of living crisis, which I'm sure does play a role. People being a little bit more conscious about how they're spending throughout the year and taking more advantage of these kind of deal days or moments. So I'm sure maybe that plays a role in this as well, but yeah, fascinating to see.
Yeah, it is a pretty crazy 7.5% higher than a year earlier, and inflation's been roaring and people have less money in their bank accounts. So
yeah,
hectic. Anyway, sorry, I need to stop saying that word, don't I? Didn't we get comments saying that my new favorite word is hectic?
Yeah.
Not hectic. Absolutely not. Completely and utterly standard.
Yeah. Google some synonyms and come up with something slightly different.
Synonyms. I'll do that when I'm not talking next. All right. Still, shoppers are price sensitive, managing tighter budgets due to last year's record inflation and interest rates. According to the Adobe survey, 79 million of the sales came from consumers who opted for the buy now, pay later flexible payment method to stretch their wallets, up 47% from last year. 47% more buy now, pay later. Hamish.
Interesting.
So people want to spend. Maybe they shouldn't be spending. I don't know. Do you have an opinion on buy now, pay later? Tash, absolutely. She hates them. She hates buy now, pay later.
I think it's the same as credit cards. I mean, if you're using it to take advantage of kind of interest-free periods and it's money that you do have, I think it really, again, it's a tool that can be used by someone who's financially smart, but most people who use credit cards, most people who use buy now, pay later are extending their spending beyond their means. So I personally don't use them. I don't really. I have a credit card, but I don't use it as like a credit card. I just do all my payments through it, and then I pay it off every single week, way before the interest payment period comes. And it's money that I already have. Of course, it's not like I'm trying to spend more than I have. So, I'm not a huge fan of buy now, pay later. I think it's probably opened the door to a lot of people who maybe didn't want to get a credit card, because they feared that they would spend too much money. And it's like a stepping stone for people to spend more money. I'm sure. I think a lot of people probably use it that way.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I tend to agree. The best-selling categories. Oh, this is interesting. Well, no, it's not interesting. It's completely expected. The best-selling categories of Black Friday, the Adobe report found, were electronics.
Wow.
Wow. Were electronics like smartwatches and televisions, along with toys and gaming. Wow. If you that's very predictable.
All the essentials.
Meanwhile, home repair tools, Hamish, people are not repairing their houses.
Right.
Home repair tools underperformed. Yes, you heard it here first.
Right.
Pandya said top sellers directly correlated to whichever products had the best discounts. There you go. You offer the biggest discount, you get the most sales. Proven in the data.
Interesting.
Adobe gathers its data by analyzing 1 trillion visits to US retail websites, 18 product categories, and 100 million unique items. It does not track brick and mortar retail transactions. Although, what did they say here? A MasterCard analysis of this year's Black Friday sales found that in-store sales rose just over 1% versus online sales, which grew by over 8% compared to last year. So this whole Black Friday, these whole shopping sprees, they are very much online only, aren't they?
Yeah, I think, I don't know about Black Friday, but for, you know, Boxing Day sales in Australia, which is the day after Christmas, you used to have to go in store to get the best deals. That used to be like a thing. Like, you would make a whole deal about getting up early and going in. Now, and I don't know how this relates to Black Friday, but now it seems like retailers are just willing to give good deals online, like, because that's where just a lot of people are shopping. So you don't really, doesn't seem like you have to go physically in, which does make it a lot easier, because shopping centers on these kinds of weekends are just an absolute nightmare.
They are indeed, Hamish Hodder. They are indeed. I do not like going to the shops when it's crowded.
No.
That is like my least favorite thing to do.
Yep.
But yes, there you go. I mean, the trends are, as you would expect, more and more spending every year. Electronics, high spending.
Yeah.
Definitely more so online than retail. I think that's pretty much in line. The only thing that caught me by surprise, I didn't expect it to be up 7.5% versus last year. I feel like that's quite the rise.
Did you take advantage of any deals over the Black Friday weekend? Because I personally don't normally do Black Friday shopping too much, because I don't really, I don't really buy all that many things. But this year I made an effort to do all of my Christmas shopping over this weekend, because I was like, I have to do it. Like, it's a good time to just get it done, take advantage of some deals. So I was very proud of myself.
Now you're finished. You got a cruisy December.
Yeah, pretty much. I got a couple of things I need to get, but I'm actually proud of myself, because usually I'm like a 20th of December organizing presents kind of guy. So I'm glad I got it out of the way.
Yeah. What'd you get me? What's my Christmas present?
Oh, well, you have to wait and see. You have to wait and see.
Oh, yeah. I'll have to wait and see. AKA nothing.
Crap, I forgot.
I got myself a present on Black Friday. I got myself a nice new sound bar, which still hasn't arrived. It still needs to be delivered.
Nice.
But I don't know. I get this thing where when I'm watching movies, I like the music and the special effects are always so loud, and then I like can't really hear what the people are saying when it's not like the action sequences. So I'm like, got the controller and I'm like jamming up the volume just to hear what they're saying, and then I'm like turning it way back down again for when the action. So I just like, I think I just need to get a sound bar and just even everything a little bit out. We'll see how that goes. I'll let you know. But it was a sound bar for me. All right.
Nice.
That's enough about Black Friday.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Hamish Hodder, tell me something I don't know.
Let's take a look at this this fraud case that I found on the Wall Street Journal, which could be contender of maybe the dumbest case of fraud in 2023. Again, it's, you know, we've covered all kinds of kind of fraud stories on the podcast. We, you know, we've recently covered FTX, and we've kind of looked at Theranos. So these are kind of big fraud cases. We've also looked at obscure ones like the New Jersey deli fraud case. That's which right. was which is an interesting story. You can probably find it on YouTube if you search New Jersey deli young investors. It'll probably come up. That's a very funny story. And this is certainly sits in the category alongside the deli. It's not a big story like FTX for sure. It's very, very small, but it is maybe one of the dumbest attempts at fraud that I've seen in quite a while. The Securities and Exchange Commission on Wednesday charged Jonathan Lamour, a Phoenix-based real estate investor, with stock manipulation. So this is a case of someone doing something illegal to make a stock move up and benefit personally from it. So what happened? So this story actually relates to WeWork, which is kind of the shared workspace company that went out of business a couple of weeks ago. I think we spoke about it, I'm pretty sure, a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. The company was kind of struggling for a long time. It eventually kind of failed a couple of weeks ago. And even though the company has been failing, of course, you could have still invested in the stock throughout November. And even today, you can still buy the stock if you can invest through the over-the-counter markets. It's not on the New York Stock Exchange anymore or the NASDAQ, wherever it was listed. But it is still a publicly traded stock, so you can still technically trade it, even though its price and value has come down pretty considerably. And when a company is near bankruptcy, the stock price can become fairly volatile because the value of the company is very small. I think it's about $50 million now, whereas it was worth multiple tens of billions of dollars at its peak. So it's a very kind of small listing now. So you kind of get these big swings based on news, and people still like to trade it, even though it's a business that's, you know, going out of business and you don't know what you're going to get as an investor, pennies on the dollar or whatever it is. People tend to like to make kind of short-term trades. And Jonathan Lamour knew this and recognized this. And he had an idea. He had an idea to make some money from the stock in a not so legal way. smudging the lines a little bit.
I haven't read ahead, so I actually have no idea what you're about to tell me. So I'm getting ready for this. I'm a viewer right now. I'm a listener right now.
So this all just happened a month ago, which is the other funny thing, because usually like the SEC, if there's a big case, it takes them a while to build the evidence and for it to actually come out after. Sometimes it takes years after something's happened for it to come out. The SEC went after this guy less than a month after this happened. So I think it tells you how obvious it was what he was doing. But earlier this month, I think it was right at the beginning of November, he started out by buying a bunch of call options on WeWork stock, which is basically a financial derivative. It's basically a way to... most people know what options are, but it's a way to make a short-term bet that the stock would rise.
He's buying contracts. He's betting the stock is gonna go up.
Correct. Yes. So that's the type of kind of option that he's buying. And at the time, the stock was worth less than $1 per share. It was about 80 cents, I believe. I don't know the exact dates when he was buying, but it was about 80 cents per share. In total, he bought 72,000 call options, which each of those call options is a bucket of 100 shares. So it was about $6 million worth of stock.
Jeez.
And that bit is fine. There's nothing illegal.
Who is this guy?
Who is this guy?
yeah, who is this guy? He's just got $6 million just to dump on a call option position?
Yeah. Well, he had an idea of what the outcome might be. So
right, so he scrounged together $6 million in the hope that he's going to be some quintillionaire or something.
Yeah, exactly. And that bit's fine, by the way. You can make a bet with call options on a company near bankruptcy. That's obviously completely legal. There's nothing wrong with that. But what he did next was very illegal. So Lemoore is a real estate investor, and he also owns an investment fund called Cole Capital Funds. So he's a real estate investor, and he owns this fund that's, you know, got obviously investors, and he puts out, you know, press releases, and he has some kind of public presence. And after he bought the call options, he issued a press release from the fund saying that the firm was looking to purchase 51% of all minority ownership shares in WeWork at $9 per share, which is nine times the price of the stock at the time. So he basically came out and said, yeah, we're going to buy, half of all of the minority shares. So not the majority owners. There's some kind of big owners in WeWork, but we're going to come out and we're buying half of all the minority shares. And not only are we going to do that, we're going to do it at nine times the current stock price.
That's hilarious.
Which I don't know the exact dates. They don't give the exact dates that he did all of this. But if you look in early November, after the stock was 80 cents per share, the stock rose more than 100% in a couple of weeks. So I don't know if that was completely related to what he was doing, or if it was partially related to what he was doing, or if it wasn't at all. But certainly it comes out being one of the dumbest cases of stock manipulation ever. Like, I just read through this and I was like, how did this guy think that he was going to get away with this? Like, he bought he dumped a huge amount into call options. That would have been a very notable position on the trading list. And then he issues this fake press release about buying shares, about buying like a huge ownership in the company.
That's not good. That's a pretty obvious one, eh? That's not bad. To put out a press release that's like completely empty, like there's not even, I'm guessing he didn't even gather any sort of evidence. He didn't like write some fake emails to his fake lawyers or something like that saying, we're considering purchasing this at this. Do you advise that this is a wise idea? We do advise on behalf of your legal team. There was none of that. There was no build up. There was just like a fake press release.
No.
Jeez, I wonder if I could do this. I, Brandon van der Kolk, am about to buy $37 billion of Apple stock. Yeah. Effective immediately.
Yeah.
Quick, where are my call options at? I'll see if I can do the same. Oh my gosh, Apple stock's gone up. It's just no way. That's just so stupid, dude.
Yeah. That's why I thought it was just so funny, because it's so blatant and it's just hilarious how quickly the SEC went for, they're like, this is the start of November. We're not even at the end of November, and the SEC has already charged it with stock manipulation, which means it was like the most easy case like that they ever had.
Yeah. imagine like the SEC knocking on his door being like, hey man, did you buy 72,000 call options in this stock? Yes. Hey, man, did you put out a press release saying you're going to buy X amount of their common shares? Yeah, I did. So did you have any intention of buying the common shares? No, I didn't. Okay, lock him up. It's like, that's how it would have gone. Bang, bang, bang.
Insane.
See you later.
Insane. And then while they were investigating him for this very ridiculous, stupid case of stock manipulation, they also found all kinds of other stuff.
which
is always the story with these cases, isn't it? It's like there's always, you know, the tip of the iceberg is like caught by the SEC, and then they just find everything else.
Yeah, that's the double shot yourself in the foot. That's the double shot.
Yeah,
of shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah. So they also found that he misappropriated $35 million in managed funds over multiple years. The SEC said that he used these funds for family member expenses and also to fund a lifestyle that included private jets, yachts, and expensive residencies.
Of course, Hamish, of course.
So, yeah, it's always the same story, isn't it? It's always the same.
That's just ridiculous. Is there, I don't know, could there be a more blatant example of fraud? I don't know. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, I don't know. He's definitely a contender for dumbest fraudster of the year.
Yeah.
I think...
yes, that'd be funny. What a category.
Yeah,
I think, send him his golden turd or something.
Yeah, exactly. A little trophy. Yeah, exactly right.
Oh, dear.
So there you go.
Well, there you go, Hamish. There you go. Yeah. All right, you want to talk about the Shein IPO, or you want to talk about Elon Musk chucking a tantrum?
Let's go Shein. Go give us the Shein IPO, cuz I haven't read anything
about it. Let's save the spicy stuff until later.
Yeah.
All right, no worries. Look, honestly, I didn't know much about this brand. It's not a brand that I've bought clothes from, but it's shaping up to be quite a large IPO over in the US.
Yeah.
So, I did a bit of digging, and of course I haven't heard about it because it is basically a company that relies entirely on TikTok. And I do not use TikTok.
Yeah.
So actually, I tell a lie. I have been experimenting with TikTok lately. If you can find me on I shouldn't say that because there's a million scammers. I think I'm like New Money YouTube is my handle on TikTok. I've put up like the same shorts that I've put up on my Instagram. Anyway, if you find me, good luck. So as TikTok took over the world, a low-profile Chinese company known for its cheap wedding dresses joined the land grab. Videos of people trying on cheap, trendy clothes from Chinese fast fashion group Shein have become a genre of their own. Surging sales mean Shein's US listing may become one of the largest in the past decade.
Wow.
Shein has filed paperwork for a US initial public offering. Backers include Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund, Mubadala. I actually don't know how to say that. Do you know how to say that?
No, Mubadala.
Mubadala. And venture capital group Sequoia China. The group has reportedly targeted a valuation as high as $90 billion, not far from its $100 billion private valuation last year.
Wow.
Shein has achieved remarkable growth. Viral videos playing to viewers' short attention spans have tapped unprecedented demands for garments, home furnishings, and pet accessories, all of which Shein provides at less than $10. Mm. The group has made a heavy and effective use of social media marketing. Here, influencers receive commissions for posts featuring Shein outfits.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a company that's gotten on the TikTok trend, and it has gone gangbusters for them.
Yeah, there's this pretty common trend on TikTok for people to kind of do these like shopping hauls and to buy like heaps of clothes, and then the TikTokers them just kind of trying on heaps of clothes. And Shein has just allowed that to explode because their clothes are so cheap. And even if the quality is really, really not that great... you can't tell the quality on a TikTok. It's just, you know, you're trying on a bunch of clothes. So, you know, people can now spend, you know, $50 and try on like 10 different things and do that over and over again. So right. It's kind of really opened the door for like anybody to build a platform on TikTok doing these shopping hauls or whatever. And it's a really, popular trend. I think it makes perfect sense. Those two, TikTok and Shein's like, fast fashion nature of just chewing out like huge amounts of really low quality clothes at really cheap prices. It's just the perfect,
right.
It's the perfect combination.
The perfect storm.
Yeah.
There you go. Hamish, I love how political you're getting these days.
Am I?
What did you just say before?
What?
they are extremely, very, they are very, very not that great.
Yeah, I'm holding back.
This company is so not great.
Well, I'm trying to not get us banned by advertisers. So I'm trying to avoid using your word.
True. True. We need to get the ads. We need to get the Shein ads in the middle of our podcast. Exactly. We need to say it more. Shein. Cheap clothing. Try on haul. TikTok. Fashion.
Yeah.
Fashion. Fast fashion. I want to buy some clothes. Black Friday sales extended. Shein. I wonder if we'll get a Shein ad somewhere.
Yep.
Anyway, what was I saying, Hamish? The US market has now become its largest with a more than 500 strong marketing. Oh my gosh, Hamish, can I speak today? With a more than 500 strong marketing operation, 1,400 people working in its warehouse in Indiana, and about 1,800 partnerships with designers and artists. Shein, which is best known for its extremely low prices, has recently ranked, get this, has recently ranked as the second most popular shopping site after Amazon among teenagers, according to a Piper Sandler survey involving 9,193 individuals.
Wow. Yeah.
That is a crazy stat. I mean, honestly, I'll be honest, I've not really heard much about this company. Granted, I don't use TikTok, so fair enough.
Yeah.
But to have it be like the second most popular shopping site after Amazon amongst teenagers, wow.
Yeah.
Hectic. No, not hectic. Something different. I didn't look up the synonyms. Ah!
That's strike two.
Shot myself in the foot.
That's strike two. Three strike strikes two. And the podcast ends.
You know what? I'm feeling hectically tired. So, all right, we'll call it there.
No. See you guys.
Hectic synonyms. Sorry, feel free to jump in if you had anything to add.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I think, you know, fair enough, a lot of people don't really like what Shein is doing to the fashion industry because it's taking fast fashion, which has already been a thing that's been around for a very long time, and just making it super, super extreme. Like, you're talking about $3-$4 items for clothes that you're going to wear once and then never wear it again. You know, it's encouraging people to spend, you know, the same amount of money, but now you're buying like so many more clothes that are going into landfill, and you know, they're clothes that even if they get donated, they're just really poor quality, so they don't last very long. And it's just adding to this, you know, enormous, one of the biggest problems that we have, which is just the enormous amount of waste there is in fashion.
It is crazy, you know,
there's a lot of negative press around Shein, which I think is fairly warranted.
Bear. Yep. That is frantic, Hamish. That is absolutely frantic. I don't know. There's no good ones. Wow. That is frenetic.
Okay.
Wow. That is fast and furious. I'm going to use that one. Whoa. Fast and furious, dude.
Wow.
All right. So anyway, valued at an industry multiple, get this, Shein would be worth almost $70 billion. That would be lower than the $126 billion market value of Zara owner Inditex, and higher than H&M's $27 billion. So pretty hectic. No, not hectic. Pretty non-hectic.
Pretty fast and furious.
Especially because they noted that Shein is expected to grow faster, a lot faster than its peers.
Wow.
Its target is to more than double sales over the next 2 years.
Crazy. So. Yeah. Well, it's actually surprising. So their valuation isn't all... So their private valuation last year was $100 billion, and they're expected to go at $90 billion, which obviously you expect the valuation to be lower than last year, you know, coming off the private... tech company, you know, crazy valuations of 2021 and 2022, but they seem, you know, somewhat more resilient, probably in part because of their enormous growth to some of that. So to still be planning to IPO near their all-time valuation is for a tech company is, you know, pretty crazy, which they are, you know, I guess they're kind of a tech company. I guess every company's a tech company now, like if you have some sort of international operations, online operations.
Yeah, so it will be interesting to see what Shein can do at IPO. But with that said, shall we move on to some inflation statistics, Hamish Hodder?
Yes. So again, we've got a couple of, we've got inflation for October for a couple of different places. We've got Australia, and then we'll also talk through the Eurozone and some of the specific countries in the Eurozone as well. So Australia, first of all, reported their October inflation figures. Their CPI eased to 4.9% compared to 5.6% recorded in September, and much better than the 5.2% expected. So big drop in headline inflation in Australia, which is obviously
good.
Continued good news. It's been, you know, moderately good news for Australian inflation for the last few months. So that story seems to continue, obviously still quite a way outside our healthy kind of 2 to 3% range in which long-term inflation should be, but certainly heading in the right direction. Good to be in the 4% now rather than the 5s. Core CPI, which excludes volatile items like energy and food, eased to 5.1%. So core inflation is still a little bit higher than headline inflation because of energy actually being negative this year compared to last year. So core inflation, does strip out some important, obviously energy and food are very important figures, but it gives us a bit of a smoother look at inflation, and it's been a little bit more useful recently. So that's sitting at 5.1%. But really interesting news on a month over month basis. So those are all year over year comparing to last year, but just comparing how much do prices change in October, prices actually declined 0.3% in October. So that's actually not only a negative figure, but it's actually quite a negative figure. Negative 0.3% is very considerable. So that's obviously, again, very good news. And interesting to see. I guess we'll see how inflation looks now after we get November and we get Black Friday. But potentially people are easing in their spending in October to spend on Black Friday. But I'm not sure if that's true. I guess we'll find out kind of next month. In terms of
very cool
the specific monthly decline, so rent was down 0.2% during the month, so this is just month over month, and then holiday travel was -7% just in the month. So those are the big kind of monthly decliners. But in terms of big movers for the year over year figure, so inflation to the end of October, housing is still one of the biggest contributors at 6.1%. Housing being kind of rent and then also increases in the cost of new dwellings. Transportation was plus 5.9%. So transportation, again, also very high. And then food and non-alcoholic beverages was plus 5.3%. So housing, food, they continue to be the big places where inflation is being felt. At a Hong Kong event this week, RBA Governor Michelle Bullock said, we're in a period where we have to be a little bit careful. We have to make sure we keep inflation under control and bring it back to our 2-3% band. But we also need to make sure that we do that in a context of not imposing on the economy too much and raising the unemployment rate too much. So just talking about that kind of fine line that every central bank is trying to walk right now, which is they want to quickly get inflation down, but they don't want to do too much to cause a big crack in the economy that maybe causes even more pain than what they're trying to fix.
Yep, I think that's pretty much the standard response from all of the central bank governors around the world, is that now that inflation's coming back down, they've got to keep it there. But at the same time, the economy is pretty bad. the antonym of hectic.
Yep.
It's absolutely non-hectic.
Yeah, yeah.
They have to make sure that they don't hurt the economy too much.
Yeah. It's pretty much take that phrase, copy and paste into ChatGPT, and say rephrase this for me next month. That's pretty much Jerome Powell and Michelle Bullock's jobs at this point.
Very true.
Then we also had Eurozone, which I don't have too much on, but I thought I'd note it because it was interesting. CPI dropped from 4.3% last month to 2.9% in October. The Eurozone, which has been one of the most affected by very sharp inflation last year, is now at 2.9%, which is obviously not only a good rate, it's a healthy rate of inflation.
That's good.
The big driver of that, of course, was energy. Energy prices are down 11% year over year. Food inflation eased from 8.8% to 7.5%. So food inflation has still been very high, but it's coming down a lot. And even core inflation was much better at 4.2%, which is obviously still a little bit outside the range, but getting a lot better. And then interestingly, if you zoom into some of the countries in the Eurozone, there's obviously quite a variance of what's happening. You had Germany at 3%, France at 4.5%, Italy at just 1.8%. And then Spain was actually one of the countries that saw an increase. They reached 3.5% inflation.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, interesting. There you go. Not too much kind of comment on inflation. It's that's pretty much the same story every month recently. So there's nothing crazy that's been happening.
Yep. We are getting there though, aren't we?
We are.
Slowly but surely. All right. Well, let's talk about, should we talk about Mr. Elon Musk before we do a couple of Q&A questions?
Oh boy. What has he done? Actually, I mean, I can't say that. I've seen what he's done.
Yeah. So Elon, my man, Elon over here, he lost it, mate. He absolutely lost it. So he recently did an interview with CNBC's Andrew Ross Sorkin at the New York Times annual Deal Book Summit, whatever the heck that is. So the story goes, he'd been accused of making anti-Semitic comments on X the other week. And in response, now he defends, like he says that what he posted was silly and foolish and that he shouldn't have done it, but he definitely defends that he is, not anti-Semite. So then what happened was that a lot of big advertisers, classic, they pulled their advertising spend on X. So in particular, Apple and Disney are the, right. are the companies we're talking about here. Now, Andrew asked Elon about this in the interview, like what are his thoughts about the comments that he made and also what he thinks about the advertisers pulling back. And what was Elon's response? He said, if somebody's going to try to blackmail me with advertising, blackmail me with money, go F yourself. Go F yourself. Is that clear? Musk signaled out Disney's CEO Bob Iger in the audience saying, hi, Bob. So he was not holding back. Very much getting fired up, the old Elon Musk.
Yeah.
But it was interesting because he definitely lost his cool. But listening to what he said, it did come across to me that he sees the very future of X under threat. He did kind of admit that a mass exodus of advertisers could very well bankrupt the company. And he wasn't keen on supporting its ongoing operations with any more of his own money.
Right.
So he kind of took the victim approach of being like, and they could bankrupt our company and then they'll have to live with that. Society will know why this has happened and they'll have to live with that. So yeah, it was an interesting start to an interview. It was definitely riled up, the old Elon.
It was a pretty, I thought the clip was great. I think,
of course you did. You some people like to see the world burn.
Yeah.
You just, I love that stuff.
I didn't see what he commented on Twitter that led to to advertisers pulling back. So I don't know anything about that,
yeah.
But there is something to be said about big companies bullying platforms into platform changes because they have big ad spend and not bending to that. I there's something that's just satisfying about that. Watching him say, no, we're not going to change the platform. I mean, it's happened on YouTube a lot.
You can.
You know, there's certain things that will happen on YouTube. Advertisers pull back and YouTube just makes a bunch of changes that are worse for creators and worse for audiences. And they're only better for advertisers. And I understand, you know, businesses have to do that, right? It's an unfortunate thing that exists. Big advertisers can impose kind of changes on businesses where they're big clients. But it was very satisfying just to see him not bend to that. But it does actually seem like, from what he said, as you said, that it's not as if he can do that and then X will just go on. It seems like, yeah, they are in maybe a bit of trouble. So that's sad.
Yeah, we obviously don't know. And it could have been Elon kind of just placing himself as the victim a little bit.
Yeah.
So there might have been that kind of angle as well. We don't know, but yeah, it was an interesting little outburst. I'll tell you that. He also traveled to Israel this week, where he met and spoke with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. When Netanyahu said he wanted to de-radicalize and rebuild Gaza, Musk offered to help. Musk told Sorkin on stage that his visit to Israel was planned before his tweets and were not part of an apology tour. He also spoke about unions, as earlier on Wednesday, the UAW launched campaigns aimed at Tesla and 12 other automakers in the US. Sorkin asked Musk what that meant for his EV business. Musk expressed generally negative views about unions and said they create, quote, lords and peasants, end quote, at companies and naturally try and create negativity, pitting workers against management. He said many people at Tesla have come up, gone from working in the line to being in senior management, and there's no lords and peasants. Everyone eats at the same table, he added. If Tesla gets unionized, it will be because we deserve it and we failed in some way.
Right. So, interesting.
I think that's an interesting take.
Hmm.
On the OpenAI, sorry, did you have anything to add on the union front, or should I talk about this OpenAI stuff?
Yeah, no, nothing really to add. Yeah.
All right. On OpenAI and its recent boardroom struggles, Musk said he had talked to a lot of people but had not found out precisely what led to the recent firing and then rehiring of CEO Sam Altman. He also said he has mixed feelings about Altman personally, hinting that he feels like the OpenAI CEO has too much power. Quote, the ring of power can corrupt. When it was founded, OpenAI's original board included both Altman and Musk, but Musk left in 2018 after expressing a potential conflict of interest with Tesla's autopilot efforts.
Hmm.
So there you go. So there you go, Hamish. Well, I still haven't made my way through the whole interview, but man, it's been an odd one so far.
Yeah.
Entertaining nonetheless.
Yeah, I've only seen that one clip. I haven't seen the rest of the interview, but it sounds like he was kind of unhinged the entire interview. So I'll have to go back and watch it. He's a funny man, yeah. Elon.
He's a funny man. All right, should we do some Q&A?
Yes.
All right, and as a reminder, if you wanted to ask a question for Q&A, you can go to the most recent version of the podcast on YouTube and drop us a comment, or you can go to the Spotify question box and drop a comment there. All right, Hamish, where should we begin?
Yeah, let's start
about,
there.
What about this one? Have you noticed that being a value investor not only influences your investments, but also the way you look at life, politics, happiness, time, money, relationships, etc.?
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting. I think that the principles of being a value investor are principles that do apply in a lot of different domains throughout your life. And I think it's also why certain people tend to gravitate towards value investing. Because I think if you already have some of these I guess principles within you in some aspect, then you're kind of more attracted to value investing as a way of investing anyway. But yeah, you know, things like patience, discipline, you know, in the recent Munger interview, he was talking about, you know, learning to identify rare opportunities and bet big when you have a sure thing. You know, that obviously applies specifically to value investing, you know, being able to identify undervalued businesses and then betting big when you have a sure thing. That's, you know, classic, you know, Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger value investing, but that also applies to many other things, whether it's your business and, you know, coming across some good idea and then going big on it, relationships, you know, identifying a rare person you want to be with and then going big on it. Like it actually applies to all kinds of aspects in your life. So yeah, I think so. I think it certainly probably has had a pretty significant impact on, you know, the way that I do things. Do you find that?
Nice. I probably find that being what I've learned, obviously, from value investing or just investing in general, is that you have to take the time to understand both sides of the argument.
Mm.
And I think that that's something that generally I try and do more of now. So I'm not quick to judge anymore. But one thing that that frustrates me is when people have one particular opinion that may not even, you know, the evidence might suggest that maybe they're incorrect, but they refuse to even consider the alternative.
Yeah.
Like I'm okay if you have a different opinion to me. I won't get annoyed at you if you have a different opinion to me. But if you are someone that is so drilled down on, you've dug your hole so deep and you refuse to even consider the alternative approach or the alternative, if you refuse to even pit one school of thought against another, then I don't know, that frustrates me a lot.
Yeah.
Well, and that's something that you need to do in investing. You need to be like, okay, I think this business is great, but why could this business be terrible? And then you need to, you know, as Charlie would say, you need to invert. So I think that's a big thing for me.
Yeah. And I think that's probably one of the things that frustrates me the most about political topics in particular. Like when there's a new topic that kind of comes up, a lot of people will just kind of look and say, like, what does my side think about this? And then that's the view that they adopt, yeah. rather than what I think you should probably do. And this is probably more of a value investing thing, which is like, what are my principles? How would my principles apply to this? How would my principles apply to this? And sometimes that means you'll agree with one side and sometimes you'll agree with the other side. I think it's a massive red flag when someone kind of just looks to and always has the views of one particular like political affiliation. That to me really bothers me because I've never kind of viewed issues that way. I always just think about trying to apply things equally across across different issues. So yeah.
Yep, agreed.
Yeah, let me. I've got a question that's directed at you, so I'll ask this one to you. Hello, guys. A question to Brandon. Great video on Charlie Munger. Can you kindly discuss? Does the warning in the video, or is the warning in the video applicable to passive investors? Again, great podcast. Thanks. We'll appreciate it.
Yeah, so I think this is making reference of the video I made fairly recently. And essentially his warning in the video, the warning that we were talking about, is that value investing from here is going to get a lot tougher than what it historically has been.
Yep.
For Warren and Charlie in their heyday. And that there won't be an abundance of opportunities going forward. Does that matter for passive investors? Nah, it doesn't. It does not at all, because as a passive investor, you're not looking for stocks to buy. Their strat is to hold, you know, buy and hold the whole market and consistently buy over time. In fact, that the less they look at individual companies or the stuff that's going on in the market, the better. That if they didn't even hear Charlie Munger talking about how it's going to be harder in the future, they would be better off as passive investors. So, I definitely think that for passive investors, a lot of the stuff that gets said, most of the stuff that gets said or that you hear is completely irrelevant, including this one.
I don't think I have anything really more to add on that.
All right. Well, we're getting through a few questions. For side hustles, did either of you ever consider ride sharing services like Uber or Lyft?
Oh, interesting. Not ride sharing services. I mean, I did all kinds of strange kind of side hustle stuff, like setting up websites and selling stuff using Facebook ads and Amazon and FBA. And I did all kinds of like kind of side hustle-y sort of stuff, but I never really did any kind of considered ride sharing. I don't think my car could be used for ride sharing, because I think it's too old. I think you have to have like newer model cars usually, or there's like a list of cars. I'm not entirely sure, but I don't think I probably could do it. But not really. No.
I did.
Really?
Well, yeah, I got so passionate about when I first got my Tesla. I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. And then I just wanted to get everybody in the car. It's just so much fun. And I stuck you in the passenger seat and we've gone around real quick in sport mode. It's just good fun.
Yeah.
So I was like, but there was actually a time where before I'd made any money at all, I was like, man, I would so love to own a Tesla. Just a Model 3. I'd had my eyes on it for a long time. It had been years and years and years until it came to Australia. I was like, oh man, I wonder if I could. And I was like, it got to a point where I sat down with myself and I was like, Brandon, would you drive Uber just to pay this car off? And I was like, you know what? I probably would. Luckily, it didn't come to that. I've never done ride sharing or Uber, but sounds like it's a, you know, I guess depending on, I guess there's mixed reviews. A lot of the Uber drivers I speak to say that it's not really great. It's not a great way to make a lot of money. It kind of sucks. But I guess at the same time, I find it cool that there is a platform. If you have a relatively new car, you can just sign up and, you know, go through your checks or whatever you need to do, show them your license, and then you can start earning money just from driving people around. I think that's cool.
Yeah.
I wish there were more kind of apps which give people just employment opportunities if they so desire, in other areas as well. I wish there were Uber equivalents for lots of different professions. I don't know. I guess it's like Fiverr, that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, I think the whole...
I like that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I think a lot of the gig economy stuff has been really interesting because it's, yeah, it is this way that people can kind of just very quickly spin up kind of a side hustle or a business without too much overhead and not having to really think too much about it. It's just kind of, there's just a bunch of apps now. Or if you're a creative, you can, you know, do like Upwork or Fiverr or something like that and loan out your services or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I think it's, yeah, it is interesting, but I've never did that. If you do ride sharing at all, and let us know in the comments if it's been lucrative for you and how it's been. Yeah.
All right, Hamish, I reckon that'll just about do us.
Yep.
What do you reckon?
Yep, sounds good. Yeah, as always, thanks everyone for tuning in. If you have any questions for next week's episode, if you're in Spotify, you can ask natively by swiping up and asking in the chat box, or head over to the YouTube version of the podcast and just click on the latest episode and leave your questions as a comment on the latest episode. Thanks to Seeking Alpha for sponsoring, as always. If you want to check out that Black Friday deal, it runs out on the 5th of December, seekingalpha.me/younginvestors for $167 a year and a 7-day free trial. So go check it out if you're interested. Thanks, Brandon, for joining me, as always. And we'll be back next week. So have a good rest of your weekend, guys, and we'll see you later.
See ya.